No, and I'll never show you another one. Well, thanks. In that case, I got them for $5 a piece and in the trunk of my car. No, those were pretty exciting days. Mary dug this up. It was hard to find. I don't know if you can see it. I'm supposed to clip it on here. This is my official tour laminate from 1989. It's got my picture on it. And it says, all access. This is my all access pass. Now, there were different levels of security in our organization. If you had just a plain backstage pass, you could get through the security guards, you know, backstage, but that was it. You couldn't go anywhere else. You couldn't go back in the dressing rooms. You couldn't go on stage or anything like that. There was an orange version of this that got you, it was for the crew only, and it got you backstage. It got you everywhere except on stage. The orange one got you a meal, because the catered meals, you got the chow line. But this blue one, this is the bad boy. This is the one you want, because this is the one that gives you access to everything, including on stage, which was the sort of highest security. And that's what I want to talk about this morning, all access. See, I told you there was a connection. Man has always been aware of a barrier between himself and God. And that's basically the reason for religions, trying to bridge that gap, trying to break through that barrier somehow to reach and know God. We just have this innate understanding that we're here and he's there somewhere. And we want to figure out, how do we make that connection? How do we gain access to God? Some people over the centuries, years and years, have tried by looking within. That's what that song was kind of about. When I close my eyes and look within, I see my life go passing by. The yogis climbed up into the Himalayas to get away from the sounds and the distractions, and they would sit in a certain posture, facing a certain direction, and put their hands a certain way and point their eyes a certain way. All of that designed to block out all the outside stimuli so that they could focus and go in. And their theory was, their hope was, that as they went inside themselves, they would find God. And then there are others, another approach, I should say, where instead of looking on the inside to find God, to know God, they look on the outside. You know, there are religions or belief systems that would see God in creation in a way other than we normally do. But they would actually, you know, worship, you know, the fire and water and, you know, the elements, air and all those things. And actually, one of the great, well, I don't mean great in the sense of really great, I mean big, one of the large world religions of this day is very much focused on God being outside of you, and you sort of jump through certain hoops. That may be a disrespectful way to say it, but kind of the bottom line. If you jump through all these hoops, if you will, you know, kneel or not kneel, or, you know, do these certain things, then even without you knowing it, you have bridged the gap. The religious exercise has accomplished that for you. And as long as you practice the religion, then you're okay. And you can mess up and foul up, and you can even do it on purpose. But as long as you follow the outward practices of the religion, then you're okay with God, and you look forward to an eternity with him in some weird way. You know, but the thing is, throughout history, mankind has always wrestled with the question, how can I know God? Now, if you've ever wrestled with that, I've got some really good news for you, because Jesus is your all-access pass to God. He gets you beyond every level of security, to kind of use that tour metaphor, that you get to go right to the heart of God, to the throne of grace, to climb up on the Father's lap and enjoy his company as he enjoys yours. Now, the first century Jewish Christians that this letter of Hebrews is written to, and if you haven't figured that out, turn to Hebrews chapter 1. These first century Jewish Christians, they had come to the realization of the awesomeness of God, the otherness of God. They had a religion, they had a way prescribed by God himself to kind of settle the account between them and God. They had to keep repeating that procedure over and over to keep the accounts balanced, but at least they did have one, and they became aware of just the awesomeness of God. You know, the Bible talks a lot about the fear of the Lord, and we've had this discussion several times. The fear of the Lord, the way the Bible uses it, is not, you would not paraphrase that, be frightened of God. That's not what the Lord wants. Although, I'll tell you, when I stand before the Lord, you probably have to check my diaper, you know, to make sure that everything is cool. Because when you're in the physical, the spiritual, the literal presence of Almighty God, there's a big, you know, heart fluttering kind of adrenaline rush and shaky knee thing that comes along with that. But the fear of the Lord in the Bible context really speaks of that knowledge, not so much that fright experience, but that understanding, you know, fear of the Lord, knowing that he is completely other than you. He's not just the best human. He's totally beyond your imagination of what a loving, creating being could ever be. And the Jewish Christians, they understood that. They had a good handle on the fact that God was greater and more awesome than anything else they could possibly imagine. Now, when we come to that realization of the awesomeness of God, how big he is, then see, we also realize how small we are. I heard Pastor Chuck the other day, Chuck Smith. He went into some of the details of creation, and he quoted that that psalm, I think it is, about when I consider the heavens, the work of your hands, and we can really do that here. You know, I like to go out in our back deck on a dark night and make sure all the lights are off, the kitchen light is off, so it's just dark, and I sit back in that chair and I just look up at the sky, and after a couple of minutes, your eyes get accustomed to the darkness, and you can just see so many stars. And now you look out there and there's a star that you may have heard of. We want to say Betelgeuse because of the movie, but it's Betelgeuse is the way you pronounce it. Betelgeuse is a star like our sun, but it's so big that you could take our sun and our earth, the way we orbit the sun, and put that whole package inside of Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse and still have like 200 million miles clearance, you know, around. I mean, it's big. And so you think about that. It makes our sun look like a BB. And then you think the sun, the earth, this little tiny blue ball, and then, you know, the North American continent and the United States and Washington and Cowlitz County and Tootle, and then my backyard and my chair and then me. And then you realize that God measures the universe, which is just the best word we can come up with to explain everything that there is. And he said it's the span of his hand. You know, it's a figure of speech. But from here to here for God is all of that. And this idea of just how huge, how overwhelmingly awesome God is, and then just how tiny, a speck of dust doesn't even describe how tiny we are. And in the Jewish system that these Hebrew readers were accustomed to, that they'd grown up with, they always felt, or it, that system made them feel, had come to make them feel, that God was unapproachable. He was so other and so awesome and so big that you dare not even approach him, that there couldn't be, that there wouldn't be a way to ever make contact with the Creator. Now, some of these folks came to the conclusion that angels maybe could bridge the gap between God and man. And then, actually, some people thought, when they heard about Jesus, they thought that he was an angel, you know, the chief angel. In fact, there's still a, how do you say it? I don't want to just rip on people, but a loosely Bible-based, well, you have to call it a cult, really, it qualifies. That's not, I don't decide these things, that will teach you and tell you and argue with you that, yes, Jesus is an angel, the chief angel of all time. And that was one of the popular beliefs in the hearts and the minds of these first century Jewish Christians. Well, Hebrews chapter 1, the passage we're going to cover today, puts all of those notions to rest. It puts all of those notions that God is unapproachable, or that Jesus is an angel, or any other such thing. What it teaches us is that Jesus is, in fact, our all-access pass to God. Let's just read this, and then we'll jump in. I'm in Hebrews chapter 1, and you might as well read a kind of verse 3 gets it going, but we really aren't going to start until verse 4. He, talking about Jesus here, the Son is how he's referred to in this passage. God's Son is the radiance of his glory, God's glory, the exact expression of his nature, and he sustains all things by his powerful word. And we looked at those in detail last week. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And so, or in doing so, he became higher in rank than angels, just as the name he inherited is superior to theirs. For to which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my son, today I have become your father"? Or again, "I will be his father and he will be my son"? When he again brings his firstborn into the world, he says, "And all God's angels must worship him." And about the angels, he says, "He makes his angels winds," or some say spirits, "and his servants," ministers, "a fiery flame." But about the Son, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. And the scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of justice. You've loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. That's why God, your God, has anointed you, rather than your companions, with the oil of joy. In the beginning, Lord, you established the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They'll perish, but you remain. They will wear out like clothing. You roll them up like a cloak, and they'll be changed like a robe. But you are the same, and your years will never end. Now, to which of the angels has God ever said, 'Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool'? Are they not ministering spirits sent out to serve those who are going to inherit salvation?" Okay. Let's jump in here to the first couple of verses. And what we're going to see here today, this passage tells us more about Jesus. Kind of picks up where we left off last week with who is Jesus. This tells us some more about Jesus, but it also tells us, or it leads us to look into some things about angels. You know, ever since that TV show, Touched by an Angel, there, you know, people hang angels on their mirror, and people wear angel necklaces and get, you know, angel book covers, even Bible covers. And, you know, obviously there's interest, great interest in angels, and we're not going to do an exhaustive study on angelology this morning, but we will see some things about the reality of the existence of angels. But anyway, here at the beginning of the section, we have access to God through Jesus because, first of all, Jesus is the Son of God. Now, you've heard that, we know that, but these readers, here, right in the fourth verse, as they start reading into this letter from an unidentified writer, he lays it right out for him. Now God has spoken to us, says verse 1, in his Son. And he goes on to describe that Son. And in verse 4, so he, when he sat down at the right hand of majesty on high, He became higher in rank than angels, just as the name he inherited is superior to theirs. Now, a couple of little word studies to get us started here. This word became doesn't mean turned into. He didn't turn into something higher in rank. This is a word that means verified or proven. It was proven, the fact that Jesus lived and died and resurrected and ascended and is seated at the right hand of God proves or verifies that he deserved everything that was already his. He was already the Son of God. He was already the creator. He was already the inheritor of everything there is to be inherited. But because of what Jesus did here on this earth and accomplished, it showed, it proved that everything that he deserves, everything that was already his. It's kind of like in the presidential election, you know, and we got one coming right up. And well, I'll be glad when it's over. But, you know, whoever we elect, there's that period of time between the election day and, of course, that was two elections ago. Was it last election? Boy, that was a nightmare. Counting the votes, you know. The votes don't count until you count the votes. But after they count the votes, and let's hope that goes a little smoother this time. They count the votes, and then the new person is president, but not yet. You got to wait till January 20th. You got to wait till the inauguration, the swearing-in ceremony. Now, on January 19th, that person is just as much president, you know, but the next day after that ceremony, it becomes official, I guess. Well, that's kind of the idea here. Jesus was already the Son. But after he went through everything he went through, and then he sat down at the right hand of God, it was verified, it was proven that he deserves what was already his. So he became higher in rank than the angels, just as the name he inherited is superior to theirs. The name he has inherited. Now this passage doesn't yet refer to Jesus by name. So far, he's the Son. God has spoken to us in Son. And here he is in the next verse. For to which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my Son"? That's not a proper name, but it's a description. It was the name he has inherited. Well, what's in a name? The name he inherited, superior to the angels. We name our children in a couple of ways. Some name their kids with family names. You know, we named our firstborn after my dad and one of my dad's friends. I know a fellow there was a tradition in his family that you name the firstborn son, his first name is the last name, is his mother's maiden name. That's how you say it. So his first name is his mother's maiden name. That's kind of a tradition that goes on. Other times, you know, if it's not a family thing or something kind of tradition, we will get one of those baby books, baby name books, and you'll try to find one. Let's name him Trapper. No, maybe not. Let's you know, and we go through these names. Boy, the vice president gal, her kids have some names, don't they? I don't want to go into that, but came to mind. They're, you know, I don't know what their names are, but it's like Flipper and Trapper and all these, you know, these names, interesting names. And whatever happened to Johnny and Jimmy and Robert and Julie and Jennifer and all those other, you know, sort of typical names. Tammy. I had an aunt, Liuna. I don't know where that came from. We didn't use that one. We forgot the family tradition on that. But you go through those books and you just find a name you like. You know, it's just pretty much that easy. Gee, Julie. Oh, that's a nice name. Let's name her Julie. Okay. And there's no special reason for it other than you just like the name. But that's not the way that names started out. That's not the way that God thinks of names. And it's not the way these first century Hebrews used a name. To them, a name was more than a label. What it was an accusation. This is who you're going to be. Now, after the fact, you can look back and say that the name is a description. And if it's not an actual description of the reality, at least it's a description of the hopes, you know, the hopes of the parents. I always wonder why did who is it? Isaiah and what's his wife's name? Not Rachel. Somebody help me out. You remember Isaiah? Not Isaiah. Golly, I did it again. I warned the praise team that I'm half brain dead today. Isaac. What was Isaac's mom's name? No, Isaac's wife. Rebecca. Thank you. And it doesn't matter, but I just had to find out. And they, you know, they had Esau and Jacob, right? Esau means red because when he came out, he was red and hairy. Jacob means dirty, sneaky thief. Heel catcher. Usurper. You know, sneak around the back. Is what, and Gail Irwin's the one that kind of coined, you know, dirty, sneaky thief. But you think, why would anybody name, and this is my son, dirty, sneaky thief? You know? It's like, what choice does the kid have about how he's going to turn out? You know, I guess you could use that as an excuse. Well, you named me. Well, Jesus, in his humanity, lived up to his eternal name, the Son. Verse 5. For to which of the angels, remember, Jesus is superior to the angels, which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my Son? Today I've become your Father"? Jesus is the Son of God. We lose track of that. We forget the significance of that. Now, you're familiar probably with John 3:16, which uses the term, "For God gave his only begotten Son." And again, we've talked about this before. Only begotten is the Greek word monogenes, and mono is where we get, you know, our first record player was a monaural. It had one speaker, one channel. Then we jumped into the new age and got stereo, two speakers. Now everybody's got 5.1 and 7.1 and subwoofers and surround sound. But, you know, mono means one. Mono, monogenes, the one and only begotten. There are other places in the Bible where the word "only begotten" are used. But this, the one in John 3:16 is unique because it's, in English, it's hyphenated, "only hyphen begotten." It's not the two words, "only begotten" and monogenes. And what it means is he's the one and only. In a sense, we're all sons and daughters of God, but Jesus is the only begotten Son of God, the one and only. And in that, because he's the Son of God, he is superior, immeasurably superior, as much superior to the angels as his name is above theirs. That's the first point. Jesus is the Son of God. Seems kind of obvious. Seems like a gimme. But when you stop and reflect on the import of what that really means, it changes everything. He's the Son of God. Now, verse 6 goes on to tell us more about the Son. When he again brings his firstborn into the world, he says, "And all God's angels must worship him." See, you, today you're my son. You're higher than the angels. I'll be your father. You'll be my son. And all the angels must worship him. He uses this word when he brings his firstborn. See, Jesus isn't the only begotten, but he's also the firstborn. Now, where begotten speaks of one and only, firstborn refers to his position or his status. You might think of the word of, you know, ranking. He's first. He's number one. Not only is Jesus the begotten Son, but as firstborn, he has superior privileges to the angels. And that's the argument here, that he's higher than the angels, that he's not an angel. Angels, it tells us, and all God's angels must worship him. See, angels worship him just like we worship him. Angels are created beings, and he is the creator. We covered that last week or the week before. And the angels worship him. See, what the writer's asking is this. Let me paraphrase. He's asked these Hebrew Christians, why do you give special honor or worship even to the creation, not to the creator? Why would you have an angel dangling from your rearview mirror, but give no thought to Jesus? Why would you have porcelain angels, an angel, and if you have one, that's cool. I want to come see it, you know. But why would you make that the center of your life? Why would you go to garage sales and secondhand stores and search eBay to enhance your collection of porcelain and glass angel figurines and never ever invest any time or any of yourself into a relationship with the one who created the angels? That's what he's getting at. It's a thing of, I want to use the word rank, but there's a better word, but levels. You know, Jesus is superior. He's at the top. Sometimes people get caught up in what I might think of as a spiritual vertigo. You know what vertigo is? It's that thing that Dave knows. What's happened to pilots? Sometimes if you're flying IFR, you're in the clouds, instrument flight rules. You can't see the ground. You can't see the mountains. All you can see is cloud, 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 cloud. And your inner ears and your sense of balance and, you know, from your rump on the seat, all of your senses are telling you you're drifting this way. You better straighten it out and straighten it out. But your instruments are telling you, no, man, you're straight and level. You're right where you want to be. But your senses are still telling you, oh, we're in a nosedive. Pull it up. And then you pull it up, but you weren't in a nosedive. But now you're in a stall because you've pointed the airplane up. And vertigo is that sense, that loss of sense of direction. And that's why in airplanes, at least, you got to trust your instruments. Well, so do we, but that's another discussion. We need to trust our instruments, which is the Word of God. But here's the thing about this vertigo. You get off track. You start talking about angels and certain methods of prayer, or, you know, a new gimmick, a new thing comes down the pike, and now this is really going to enhance your walk with the Lord, and you buy the book, or you buy the tape, or you buy the new thing to hang from your rearview mirror, whatever, but you get vertigo, and all your senses are telling you this is the way to go, but you're not where you think you are. That's what was going on with these folks. They thought they were doing the right thing, but they weren't. See, when we keep Jesus at the center of our lives, when he's that horizon that we're looking at to make sure we're straight and level, we're assured of an access to God that angels cannot provide. See, even if you were to have an encounter, a real encounter with a real angel, well, I want to go to the throne room of God. The angel would say, sorry, man, I don't have that. You know, my backstage pass doesn't give me that privilege. But Jesus does. He's the creator. In verse 2, we learned it. Through whom he made the universe, and angels are his creation. Okay, let's keep moving on here. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the firstborn of God. And the third thing it tells us here is that Jesus is unchanging. And that's an important point. Look at verse 7. About the angels, he says, he makes his angels winds. And your translation might say spirits. It's the same word, wind, breath, spirit, pneuma. It's all the same. And his servants, that your translation might say ministers, a fiery flame. Well, the angels are, you know, like the wind. They're like fiery flames. But here's a contrast. About the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever. Don't miss the point that here God calls him God. God the Father calls Jesus God the Son. God calls him God. But your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Jesus is unchanging. The scepter of your kingdom. The scepter always stood for the authority. It's kind of like we think of a policeman's badge. Without the badge, you're just another dude. Don't you dare pull me over for speeding if you're not a real cop. But if you've got that badge on, then I guess I have to, you know, submit. I have to cooperate with you. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of justice, describing his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. That's why God, your God, has anointed you rather than your companions with the oil of joy. And verse 10, in the beginning, Lord, you established the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They'll perish, but you remain. They'll wear out like clothing. You'll roll them up like a cloak, and they'll be changed like a robe. But you are the same, and your years will never end. Jesus is unchanging. You know, we should lock onto that. You got to lock onto that idea that Jesus doesn't change. There may be a time, there may be an occasion or a situation where you think that Jesus just doesn't love you anymore. He can't love me now. I mean, I've turned my back on him and I've gone my own way. And if I were to return to the Lord, he would just sort of, you know, kick me out, or, you know, they wouldn't let me in the first place. Or maybe you followed the Lord, but then you kind of drifted away and you stopped fellowshipping and you stopped having time in the Word, and your relationship with God is kind of a distant memory that you have, but it's not active. It's not current. It's not the first thing you think of every morning and the last thing you think of as you drift off to sleep. And you think, well, I used to have it, but I lost it. And I just, you know, the Lord will never, you know, he doesn't love me anymore. He won't accept me anymore. I mean, I used up all the grace there is and there's no grace left. Well, no, think again. You got into something that's just so wrong, even by your own standards. But you gave in and you gave up and you're in it. And then you come to think, oh man, I'm in too deep. I can't turn back to the Lord now. He'd laugh at me. He'd reject me. But Jesus never changes. He loved you before you were born. He loved you before you were conceived. He loved you before you put your faith in him. He loves you now, and he always will. There's nothing you can do to make Jesus stop loving you. There's also nothing you can do to make Jesus start loving you. He can't love you more, and he won't love you less. And that never changes. It's 1 Corinthians 13, right? The love chapter. And one of those great descriptions of the love of God is that love never fails. Love never quits. Love never gives up. You know, there's nothing like a mother's love. I can't believe my mom didn't just give up on me. Well, I did my best, but he's stubborn and stupid and young and foolish, and he's doing his own thing. But she never did. You know, she just never stopped. And no mom ever does. And God never does. He just never stops. He's the changeless, eternal creator. And the point of this whole letter to the Hebrews is to say, never back off from making him the center of your life. Never back off. There's no reason to back off. If you fouled up, confess it. He'll still love you. He'll forgive you. He'll accept you. It's never too late to turn back. He never changes. You say, Lord, I don't know what got into me. I stood at the edge of the cliff and I jumped. And Jesus says, yeah, I knew you were going to do that. You knew? Yeah, I knew you would, but that's okay. We'll pick you back up. We'll dust you off and clean you up and get back on the path. Just follow me. You know, take up your cross, deny yourself, follow me. We'll just keep going. I still love you. Never back off from making him the center of your life. So the next question, what then is the role of angels? Trying to put ourselves in the place of the original readers here, these Jewish Christians who maybe were toying with the idea that Jesus was just an angel, or that in some other way an angel could somehow help us, you know God, get closer to God. What actually is the role of angels? And verse 14 tells us, are they, the angels, not all ministering spirits sent out to serve those who are going to inherit salvation? Now, look at that last part again. Those who are going to inherit salvation. Who's that? That's us. Now, what about angels? Are they not all ministering spirits? Yes, they are. They're all ministering spirits sent out to serve those who are going to inherit salvation. Well, how does that work? Do we have guardian angels, really? Well, it would seem so. I can't help but think of the way that Frank Peretti describes that spirit world in his novels, and I don't think he claims, and I have no reason to believe that's a factual description. It's just a what if, and you know, it could work this way. But according to the scriptures, angels are ministering spirits to serve you, to serve those who will inherit salvation. And whether it's one, you know, big Frank Peretti, 9 foot tall, incredible Hulk of an angel, or whether it's, you know, who knows what Elijah allowed Elisha to see when he opened his eyes and there was the host of heaven, the angelic host on all the mountains from horizon to horizon. But angels are real. They're under the authority of God, and their job is to look after you. Now, the scripture tells us, and I'm going to stick primarily, well, no, I'm not. I'm going to include some Old Testament stuff too, but I'm just going to give you 7 descriptions of the role of angels in the lives of believers. And the first couple are in that, you know, the Christmas story. It was an angel in Luke chapter 1, or angels, that revealed the birth of Jesus to man. I mean, those shepherds saw something. It was an angel that spoke to Joseph. You know, angels reveal things. Angels guide. It was an angel that told Joseph to marry Mary. That was under the instructions, the guidance of an angel. In 1 Kings, it's an angel that provides food for Elijah. He's just kind of holed up, you know, everybody hates me, nobody loves me, I think I'll go eat worms kind of a deal. And, you know, he's out in the middle of nowhere, and it's an angel kind of wakes him up. You can read this in 1 Kings 19 and says, here, you know, eat. The angel had made some bread, you know, a cake, it's called. So angels provide. Angels also protect. In Daniel, who is it that shut the mouth of the lion when Daniel was thrown into the lion? It's an angel. Angels deliver, or rescue might be a better word. In Acts chapter 5, who was it that released the apostles from prison? It was an angel. Came and turned them loose. You can read about that, Acts 5:17. The angels strengthen and encourage. Remember Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist, and then he goes out into the desert, and he's fasting for 40 days, fasting and praying and being not tempted, but tested, proven. And then the enemy left him, and it says angels came and ministered to him. I don't know. If they were Jewish angels, they brought him a bowl of chicken soup or something, you know. They took care of him, though. That's what angels do. They strengthen and encourage. The angels are agents in answering prayer. In Acts 12, Peter's in prison. He's praying, and the answer to the prayer comes in the form of an angel, again, turning him loose. The role of angels, revealing, guiding, providing, protecting, delivering, strengthening, encouraging, answering prayer. Aren't you glad the angels are looking after you? Try to think like an angel for a minute. And there's your, you know, he's watching you go about your day. And you're driving, you know, into town. You got to go to the store, or you're going to work or whatever. And somebody, you know, does something, cuts you off or won't let you in, and you say a couple of those choice, you know, words that kind of express exactly how you feel about that individual. And the angel just kind of goes, you know, maybe you gave him the backside of the peace sign, and, you know, or that anger rose up within you, and the angel just goes, why don't you just chill in the grace and the love of God? Get to work 10 seconds later. Who cares? Let that guy go first. You ever think about that? Especially when you got one of those Grace Happens bumper stickers on your car. You better let that guy go first. Of course, you want to get in front of him so he can see the bumper sticker. But if grace happens, then let grace happen. But, you know, the angels just kind of, they must just shake their heads, and sometimes they must cry. Because they realize what the Lord offers us and what the Lord did to make that offer possible. possible. They realized that the Son became a man and lived and was murdered and was resurrected. And they realized that all the Lord demands of us is that we simply believe that and trust Him and then just walk in this daily self-denying, cross-carrying relationship with Him. And it's really just that easy. And then we make it so hard. And then we forget about it. We ignore it or we turn away from it. And then we turn back and we're in and we're out and we're back and we're gone. And the angels must just go, what is up with these things? These bags of water and flesh that you created. What's the point? Which we're going to get to in a minute. See, here's the last question. What is the believer's relationship with angels? We know what they do. We know that it's Jesus, not the angels, that gives us all access to the Father. But what is our relationship with the angels? Just a couple of things. Someday, it tells us in 1 Corinthians 6:3, we will judge the angels. He puts it in the form of a question. Do you not know that you will judge the angels or judge angels? Now, it's that word krino, judge. It's not a judgment of, you know, life or death. It's not a thumbs up, thumbs down. It's more of a score or a rating. Now, I can't begin to tell you exactly how, you know, do I not know I'm going to judge angels? No, I don't know. I don't know how that works. Who am I? How does that work? I guess we'll find out when we get there. So it means that rating. There's one theory or one possibility, I guess, when it comes to judging angels, rating angels. In one sense, it could be that rating of a performance, the way that our judgment, the krino before the Lord, determines our score, like the Olympics. Well, he gets a 9.5, and that one only gets a 7.2, and then our rewards are based on that judgment. So maybe it's like that. Well, this angel did a good job. Boy, you should have kept me out of that one mess. You only get a 5.9. You know, it could have been a 6. You know, I don't know if it's that frivolous or not. The other option, I guess, it could be a judging or a rating, a determining between the fallen angels and the angels that didn't fall. You know, when Satan was cast out of heaven, a third of the angels mutinied against God and followed Lucifer. Someday, we will judge them. Now, we already talked about in verse 14, their job is to minister to us. Their job is to, all those things we talked about, reveal things, guide us, provide for us, protect us, deliver us, strengthen, encourage, follow God's instructions in answering prayer, however that works. But here's something about our relationship with angels that really is powerful. According to 1 Peter 1, in fact, let's just turn there. It's just up a little bit, a few pages. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 and 11. These two verses complement Hebrews just perfectly. Concerning this salvation, being saved by grace through faith in Jesus because of what he's done, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that would come to you, which we talked about from verse 1, God, in past times, God spoke to the fathers through the prophets. Concerning this salvation, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that would come to you searched and carefully investigated. They inquired into what time or what circumstances the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating when he testified in advance to the messianic sufferings and the glories that would follow. Now, I realize fully that's an expanded translation compared to your NIV or NASB or whatever. But what he's saying is the prophets were trying to figure out, when's all this going to happen? They weren't given the understanding of exactly point by point, how is this going to unfold? They were just given kind of a vague vision and understanding of certain things, and they followed the Spirit of the Lord and wrote those things down as best they could. And that's what Peter's talking about. Concerning salvation, the prophets who prophesied about it searched, you know, tried to figure it out. They inquired of the time and circumstances about the Spirit. It was revealed to them, verse 12 now, that they were not serving themselves, but you, the believers, the church, concerning things that have now been announced to you through those who preached the gospel to you. See, the preaching of the gospel filled in the blanks by the Holy Spirit of heaven. And here it is, the last part of verse 12. Angels desire to look into these things. See, we're privy to information about salvation that even the angels never had. And it's Ephesians that tells us how all of creation is going to marvel. And I just love this. When God wraps this whole thing up, you know, everybody out of the pool, we're done, and it's a new heaven and a new earth and a new eternity and all the, you know, the ramifications of that. And the, not only the angels, but all of creation is going to go, I had no idea. I had no idea. All that's the sin and the suffering and the earthquakes and the tidal waves and the death and divorce and destruction and pain and sickness and heartbreak and all that mess we had, couldn't figure out why is God letting this happen. And then all of a sudden, wow, look what he did through these people that he created. He started with Adam and Eve. You familiar with the idea of a security blanket? My friend Ronnie, who was here in the video with me, when their little girl, Lori, was born, when she got up to be walking around age, she had a blanket. It was her Bobby. I don't know why they named it Bobby. And she wasn't going to go anywhere without that Bobby. I mean, she wouldn't go to bed without it. She wouldn't get in the car without it. She wouldn't go to church. She wouldn't go to grandma's. She was going to take that Bobby. She was going to drag it around kind of like Linus in the Snoopy cartoon. She had to have that Bobby or she would just throw a wall-eyed fit and there was no reasoning. You just got to go back and get it. Because for some reason, she locked onto that blanket and when she had that and felt that and smelled it, it made her feel like everything was okay. More so than mom holding her or rocking her or anything dad could say. It was that security blanket. Well, see, the Jewish Christians were insecure without the blanket of the law. All their lives they grew up, if you follow the rules, everything's going to be fine. And then here comes the gospel saying, it's not about the rules anymore. It's about trusting God. It's about faith. And they just didn't know what to do. And so they were searching for a way and they're looking into angels and they're looking into all kinds of stuff to know God when they had a way. They had a way. They already had the way. It was Jesus Christ. We have the ultimate security blanket of direct access to God. Not through the way we act, not through angels, but through a living relationship with the Son of God. The firstborn, the only begotten, the eternal Son of God. Jesus is our all access pass to God. And the only thing we need to do is by faith just pin that baby on. And everybody else steps out of the way, and because of Jesus, you're ushered into the presence of God. Let's pray. Father, sometimes we forget. We get so caught up in our activities. I mean, even our church, you know, our Bible studies and our meetings and our stuff, our potlucks and our painting and, you know, putting up fences and cutting down trees. And sometimes we get so caught up in all that stuff that we just kind of lose sight for a minute of exactly who it is that motivates and instigates all this. It's Jesus, not the fair-skinned guy in the painting, the European-looking guy in the painting, but the eternal Son of God. No matter what his face looked like, the eternal, the firstborn, the only begotten, our big brother who suffered and died for our sin, for the mistakes we made, for the bad decisions we made, for the giving in to the pull of the desires of the flesh. For all of that, he gave his life so that he could square things. He could give us access to all we ever wanted in the first place, which was the peace of God, the joy of God, freedom from the power of sin, fellowship, love. Forgive us for when we lose sight of that, and help us to reestablish that, reestablish you, Jesus, as the center of all that we think, say, and do. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name.